Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the final Republican debate before Tuesday's New Hampshire primary and speak with David Graham, a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he has an article, A Rough Night for the Frontrunners. We'll discuss the robotic response that Marco Rubio had to sharp criticism from Governors Bush and Christie that appear likely to slow Rubio's rise in the polls as a seemingly over-caffeinated candidate kept resorting to his canned attack lines that suggest President Obama is some sort of Manchurian candidate who is serving alien interests and using his presidency to destroy the United States from within. Then we'll examine the fallout from the North Korean launch of a long-range missile that has the UN Security Council convening an emergency meeting to decide on a response. Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University and author of Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990, joins us to discuss the latest attention-grabbing act by North Korea's boy emperor, who has all of the Republican presidential candidates calling for more sanctions and increased pressure on China to lean on its erratic neighbor. Then finally, we'll assess the possibility of a Saudi and Turkish military intervention in Syria as Russian, Iranian, and Hezbollah forces rapidly change the military situation on the ground with their offensive to cut off and encircle Aleppo as it gains ground, forcing more and more refugees to flood into Turkey. Henri Barkey, who served on the policy planning staff at the State Department, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, Erdogan's Foreign Policy is in Ruins, and the extent that Russia is creating facts on the ground while the U.S. complains indignantly from the sidelines. And joining us now is David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National, and his latest article at The Atlantic is A Rough Night for the Frontrunners. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Graham.
Thank you for having me.
And it was pretty clear that Marco Rubio, I don't know whether he was ambushed or not, but he sure came under some pretty withering attacks, particularly from Governor Christie. And he did look rattled. He looked absolutely like he was the sort of the boy in the bubble, and the bubble had burst around him.
Yeah, I mean, it was a weird moment. As you said, it seemed like he'd been ambushed, but his aides were saying ahead of time that they expected that his rivals would attack him. And Chris Christie's been talking about Rubio offering canned soundbites on the stump for a couple of days. So this really shouldn't have been a surprise, but it appeared to be.
So why then did he resort to canned responses? In fact, kept repeating them.
That's a really good question. I mean, it's interesting. It was interesting to watch because here you have Christie accusing him of using canned responses, and Rubio's response is simply to say the same thing over again. I think that's what he's comfortable doing. His stump speech has gone well. He knows it really well. He wants to stick with it. And he's been doing the same thing throughout the debate. I mean, from the first debate, reporters who have watched him on the stump are saying, this is just his speech over and over again. But his rivals and viewers are slower to pick up on that because they're not watching him on the stump every day.
So what do you think, though, is, I mean, it strikes me as bizarre the way he keeps going on about Obama. And it really is as though he's saying that Obama is some kind of Manchurian candidate who's working for alien interests and is destroying America from within. I mean, I'm not resorting to hyperbole like some of these other candidates do. That's just in essence what he's suggesting. It may not be exactly what he's saying. Go ahead.
I think, you could put a slightly more friendly gloss on it, which is to say, well, he's saying that, the charge against Obama for much of his administration, obviously, has been, this guy has no idea what he's doing. And Rubio's claim is, no, look, he's been so effective. He's passed all these liberal policies, and those liberal policies are bad. We don't want that, but, don't say he hasn't been effective. Where it shades into the kind of Manchurian candidate thing is when you start talking about foreign policy, and they accuse Obama of wanting to make America weak and of selling America out with the Iran deal and so on and so forth. But, Ted Cruz has made the same argument. It's what these guys have to do to take the edge off their inexperience, but it doesn't always work.
But what do you think he means when he says Obama wants to make us like the rest of the world?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a reprise of this thing that many Republicans have been on since, I guess, really since the 2008 campaign, that Obama doesn't believe in American exceptionalism, and that he doesn't think that America has a role to play in leading the world on the edges. It sort of shades into kind of one world governance stuff on the fringes. But I think that's basically what it is, this idea that Obama doesn't believe in America's role in the world.
And again, I'm speaking with David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he has an article, A Rough Night for the Frontrunners. And in terms of the frontrunners, I take it you mean Trump, Rubio, and Cruz. I'm not sure I'd agree with you, David, that Trump had a bad night. I thought he actually pretty much dominated the entire debate, even though he didn't resort to his usual histrionics.
That's an interesting point. I mean, I thought he got hammered pretty hard on the eminent domain question. And a lot of, there are also times when he seems sort of absent. But it's true. I mean, he didn't have a terrible night, and he didn't have his moments. He has that ability, even when he's not making a lot of noise, to sort of remain the center of attention.
Well, but the great advantage he has, though, is that he's not like any of these other candidates. He can absolutely break all the rules. And I thought it was extraordinary that when the crowd booed him, that he turned on the entire crowd and said, basically, you're all in the bag for these candidates, because the RNC only lets in big donors in the audience. And I tried to get tickets, and I couldn't. I mean, I don't know whether that's an accurate charge, but it was pretty, I thought, ballsy of him.
Oh, yeah. And my understanding is that the audience was very much Republican establishment audience. Those are obviously not people who back Trump anyway. And so I think bashing them could come off really well for him. It was weird to see so many people in the audience booing him. That was an interesting dynamic.
Right. So then let's turn to Cruz then. What was your impression then that he, since, you know, the implication is that he had a rough night, he certainly didn't shine. I think in many ways Rubio was exposed. His weaknesses were glaringly exposed, but what was your take on Cruz's performance?
I thought Cruz had a couple of really tough moments, and the first one was right at the beginning. There's been a story ongoing about Cruz staffers and organizers saying that Ben Carson's about to drop out and encouraging his supporters not to caucus for Carson. And Cruz got this question about it, and you know, he apologized to Carson, and he said it was a misunderstanding. And then Carson came right at him and basically accused him of lying and showed that what he was saying was not entirely true. So I think that threw him off from the beginning, and it really gets at questions of his honesty. And then later on, I mean, he got this question about, he keeps talking about wanting to carpet bomb ISIS, which doesn't make a great deal of military sense. And often he gets away with that, but Martha Raddatz hammered him on, why would this work against a diffuse force, and what do you mean? And he doesn't have a good answer for that.
Well, he did seem to have a good moment, though, and for the first time ever, he seemed like he had some humanity, because he's not a very pleasant guy from all accounts, and he's not well-liked, and he doesn't have a particularly winning persona. But when he talked about his, I guess it was his sister-in-law?
Half-sister.
Half-sister, is that what it is? Yeah. That had a drug problem and eventually overdosed. It was actually a fairly moving story.
Absolutely. It was, I think, a really human moment for him, and he was showing his emotion. I mean, the funny thing about that, he ends that by saying, and what we need to do is close the borders. So he takes this very human anecdote and turns it into kind of a rote policy proposal, and you wonder, what's the point of having... What's the point of your personal experience and then of using your personal experience as a political tool if your answer is going to be so conventional and kind of beside the point?
Well, he sure did. I agree with you that Dr. Carson absolutely nailed him, even though Carson, you know, basically said up front, look, I'm an adherent to Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment, which is don't speak ill of another Republican. And then he turned around and basically said you've effectively lied. He didn't say it, he implied. And that after Trump had said what great friends he is and how he's friends with his wife and all this stuff, and at the end Trump, Carson said, well, you know, that's not exactly what happened. This is what happened. And, you know, I thought it was pretty powerful. But this guy is amazing. The truth is a moving target with him. He will basically pretty much say anything, won't he? I mean, he's extraordinary the way he makes up stuff. He almost eclipsed Carly Fiorina in describing his own reality.
Well, with Fiorina off the stage, someone has to fill that niche.
I see. So, is it possible, though, that these results are going to be quite different from what perhaps the pundits are saying? I mean, obviously, Trump has a substantial lead. And I think, if anything, he'll probably go up in the polls after this debate, which, by the way, the basic question to ask, and maybe you've got an answer here, how many people watched it in New Hampshire where it counts? Are we just talking about something in a bubble here, or did the whole state watch this debate?
You know, I haven't seen a number for how many people in New Hampshire watched, but I think that's a very good question.
Yeah.
I hear a lot of the spin saying, I mean, I think very clearly Rubio had a bad night. And reading a lot of the reaction this morning, you get the sense that some people are convinced Rubio is toast. And I'm wary of making any prediction that definitive when we don't know how many New Hampshire people actually watched it and we don't know how they reacted versus how the pundits reacted.
Well, but presumably people in New Hampshire at least read the day after in the newspapers and on TV, which, you know, pretty much described him as Marco Rubio as a loser. So I guess I don't know how you do the math on this, but it would seem to me that it's likely that Kasich will do well and so will Jeb Bush, or better than they have before. And so at whose expense, given that this is a different state, you know, it's not dominated by evangelicals, so Cruz doesn't have the same base that he was able to pander to in Iowa. If anything, he's at a huge disadvantage. It's a very secular state, and it seems to favor people like Republicans, like Kasich and Jeb Bush. So if they come up, And even Christie, who was obviously fighting for his life, because probably have to drop out. So will Carson have to drop out if they don't do well. I'm not sure whether he's going to do well. But if it is to be that Kasich and Bush will go up, at whose expense will that be?
I think probably Rubio is the big one. I think Cruz, as you say, is likely to suffer, although also, as you say, he came into this race a little bit weaker. I mean, I think the question to how well they do may depend in part on where Trump pans out and whether people break toward something a little bit more proven or if they stick with Trump. You know, Christie's an interesting case. He was doing really well in New Hampshire just a few weeks ago, got some crucial endorsements and was kind of, I think, ahead of both Bush and Kasich. And now he's slid back. So the question is, last night he do the number on Marco Rubio, but did he help himself or did he come across as kind of a jerk? And that'll determine, I suspect, how well he does.
Well, but he doesn't have the patina of a winner, does he? I mean, he's never really gotten more than single digits.
Well, he had that brief spike. I mean, I think if you had asked me a month ago whether I thought it would be Christie or Kasich ahead, I would have gone with Christie. And instead, he's sunk over the last few weeks, which makes me wonder how fluid things are and whether it's just that he doesn't have that patina or if he has the ability to bounce back.
Well, we know that Rubio's got a lot of money behind him, that's for sure, with Adelson, the billionaire, basically saying he's all in for Rubio. And I'm wondering whether, since Rubio is the sort of choice of the neocons, and he's very much their spokesperson, their track record is not great. You know, they're the ones who discovered Sarah Palin, and she briefly had a moment in the sun, and then the more she opened her mouth, the more she collapsed. So is there a possibility that they'll be on another losing streak here?
Yeah, it would be ironic if that was the case, since Rubio's problem is not that he can't stay on message, but last night that he was too adept at staying on message and came across as robotic. A lot of people seem to think that the neocons were sort of finished coming into this election, and what we see with the rise of Rubio is they still have some punch, The question is how much. He's also contending with all this money from Jeb Bush's super PAC, which includes some neocon backing who've been softening him up and really, I think, hurting his poll numbers over the last month.
Well, apparently there's a tremendous animus and bitterness that Bush feels towards his former protege, and he's got a considerable war chest to spend on. I mean, it's almost as if I don't make it, I'm going to make sure you don't make it.
That's how it feels, absolutely.
So, I don't know whether you saw this interview the other day on the Wall Street Journal with the billionaire hedge fund guy, Stephen Schwarzman, from Davos. And he was asked, what are the three big, by the Wall Street Journal reporter, what are the three big things you're worried about the economy and given that the stock market's in turmoil? And he said, well, it's the Chinese economy, one. Secondly, it's the fall in oil prices. And thirdly, it's Bernie Sanders. I thought, what? That got my attention. And he sort of said that, Bernie Sanders is really rattling Wall Street. But at the end of the interview, he said, we here in the United States, to us, this presidential election is a local election. But to the rest of the world, it's a national or an international election. And then he, and obviously he's been a Republican, supports Republican, and he basically said, the Republican field is a disaster. So do you get that feeling that the establishment at this point is alarmed and they don't really have a horse they can really bet on?
Yeah, I think they are alarmed, and I think last night enforces that. I mean, there was a moment, it seemed, coming out of Iowa where Rubio was going to consolidate that support and he was going to drive one together, and he would be either the anti-Trump or the anti-Cruz. But with a stumble like last night, I mean, it means that people no longer have that kind of confidence. They're going to have second thoughts. They're going to start looking at the other guys again. And it means that it's going to take longer for them to crystallize around Rubio or someone else to try to stop Cruz or Trump. Makes it more likely that Cruz or Trump wins the nomination and makes it worse for the establishment.
So I guess, there's a lot more to come with South Carolina and Nevada, and then of course Super Tuesday. So it's still pretty early. But if it pans out as expected, at least as I think you and I suspect that Trump will win, but that Kasich and Jeb Bush will do better. I don't know about Christie, but. How will that affect the big mo, the momentum coming out? Because obviously it's going to be good for Bernie Sanders because I think he's foregone conclusion that he's going to win.
Yeah.
And he'll be really, I think, taken seriously by the press for the first time. So what do you expect the headlines are going to be on Wednesday?
Oh, man. I'm nervous about that kind of prediction. I do think, the first thing is we're likely to see a smaller field by the time they get to South Carolina, because you have to imagine that of Bush, Kasich, Christie, and Fiorina, and maybe Carson, at least two or three of them are going to drop out. I think if Trump pulls out a win, then the story is going to be that Trump has the momentum back headed to South Carolina where he polls well, and suddenly he's back in the catbird seat. If Trump collapses again, it's hard for me to imagine his campaign really ever regaining momentum. And then the question is how the results pan out for Rubio versus Cruz and who might be able to take advantage in South Carolina and steal the lead from Trump.
Well, David Graham, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Graham, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National. And his latest article at The Atlantic is A Rough Night for the Frontrunners. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the fallout from the North Korean launch of a long-range missile.
They're programmed to destroy us. She's gotta be strong to fight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His latest book is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990, now out in paperback. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Armstrong.
Hello, nice to be with you.
And the UN Security Council is meeting in an emergency session to figure out their response to this North Korean launch of a long-range missile, which they allege was launching a satellite. But everybody seems to think it was actually a test of a long-range missile that could at some point in the future have a nuclear payload. There was obviously on the Republican debate last night, almost, I think every candidate called for stiffer sanctions and more pressure on China. But the expectation from the UN Security Council is that they will put more sanctions on. So what would these extra sanctions be and what would they do, do you think?
Well, the Security Council actually just released a statement about an hour ago condemning the satellite launch, the rocket launch. And they pointed out that even if it is a satellite launch, that the use of ballistic missile technology is prohibited by UN sanctions. So the fact that if it is in fact the case that as North Korea claims this was a satellite launch, that's still in defiance of UN sanctions. There are a series of sanctions that have been imposed on North Korea for the last 10 years, beginning in 2006. It's not clear what exactly they're going to do next. The Security Council talks about further significant measures. It might be that they'll go more directly after North Korean financial interests, banks, and so on. But this, again, as always, depends on China's cooperation. And China has been less aggressive in their language. They've talked about regretting the satellite launch and calling for a negotiated solution to the problem. So really, even if the UN calls for stronger sanctions, much of it hinges on how far China is going to go in enforcing those sanctions.
So if they were to cut the North Koreans off from the international financial system, would that just mean that the North Koreans would have to work through the Chinese, and perhaps that would be one way to get China's attention?
Yes, well, North Korea is largely cut off from the international financial system as it is. And the problem with sanctioning North Korea, unlike Iran, for example, is that North Korea is already pretty significantly isolated from the outside world, as we all know. These sorts of sanctions really are not necessarily going to be as effective as they would on a country that, for example, dependent on oil exports as Iran does. North Korea can get by, we've seen, still under a pretty strict sanctions regime. If China were to close down North Korean financial interests in China itself, this might have more of an effect, but China has been always reluctant to do that.
But the U.S. is talking about now deploying these anti-missile batteries, I guess something like the Patriot missiles, in South Korea. And it's got both China and Russia expressing opposition to that idea, particularly China, saying it's deeply concerned about the deployment of U.S. anti-missile systems in South Korea. Surely they must understand that that's fairly a predictable response, isn't it?
Yes, it is a predictable response. On the other hand, the Chinese and the Russians, to a less extent, are very concerned about the U.S. posting anti-missile defenses in South Korea, and the South Koreans are in a bit of a bind. It would be very interesting to see how China reacts if the U.S. and South Korea do go forward with this, because the Chinese could possibly retaliate against South Korea, which is very dependent on China for trade and so on. So this dependency actually runs both directions, and this is turning into a very unpredictable confrontation between China and the U.S., which we don't know how it's going to fold out in the coming unfold in the coming months. Another thing that is going to happen, and that's already been talked about in the North Korean media, is in another 2 months or so, the U.S. and South Korea are going to engage in military exercises, and they're talking about having them very robust, which will encourage North Korea even more to develop its own defenses. So we're seeing an escalation of both sides, which could be very dangerous in the coming weeks and months.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His latest book, just out in paperback, is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. So let's talk about the tyranny of the weak, because I think that's the key here. If you go to this country that has nuclear weapons and developing long-range ballistic missiles, yet its people are starving you know, you just have to look at satellite pictures at nighttime. There's virtually no lights on in the entire North Korea. They're stuck back in a kind of 50s time warp with this sort of boy emperor running the place. And he's very skilled, as was his father and grandfather, particularly, well, not so much his grandfather, but certainly his father, in terms of getting attention by essentially behaving badly and being, in effect, rewarded for bad behavior. So we're talking here about UN sanctions, but at the end of the day, perversely, it always seems like the Kim family end up getting rewarded.
Yes, they're masters of this going back for half a century. They've been running a small and relatively weak country surrounded by much more powerful neighbors, China, the U.S., Russia, Japan, and now relative to South Korea as well. But they've been extremely astute at manipulating external fears and rivalries in order to get their way. They did it between China and the Soviet Union during the Cold War days, trying to get concessions from both sides. And they're, in a way, playing off China and the U.S. and that rivalry today. And their economy is suffering, although it isn't as bad as it was a decade ago. But that's not really their priority. When you have a country as isolated as North Korea, centralized on this leadership of the Kim family, what really matters to the leadership is their hold on power. And this seems to be very much what Kim Jong-un is doing, to demonstrate his strength to his own leadership and to his own people by, as he claims, standing up against the U.S. by launching a missile and then before then the nuclear test of last month. So they are still practicing what I call tyranny of the weak and getting away with it.
And they certainly got the attention of all of the Republican candidates in last night's debate. They were all quite exercised about the North Korean test. And interestingly enough, in Friday night's debate on the Democratic side, when asked, both candidates, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, were asked what worries them most in terms of the foreign policy landscape, Bernie Sanders said North Korea. So why do we care so much about this dysfunctional sort of hermit kingdom?
Well, it's first of all been something that has been a concern of the U.S. for a long time. We have close allies in the region, South Korea and Japan, that could be threatened by a provocation and certainly any kind of conflict with North Korea. And it is of great concern to many, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere, that North Korea could develop long-range nuclear strike capabilities. I mean, that would be what really would change the security equation. We don't have any evidence yet that North Korea could actually put a nuclear weapon on a missile and send it a long distance. If it did, then we have a really different game here. So you could ignore North Korea, which is essentially what the Obama administration has done for the last several years, but the problem is going to go away. North Korea's nuclear arsenal will expand. Its missile technology will improve, and eventually we're going to get to a point where we could have a very dangerous standoff that could escalate into a regional conflagration. So people should be concerned about North Korea, even though it doesn't at this point mean a direct threat to the U.S.
So this missile that's named after Kim's father was supposedly a big success, but all of the talk that one hears, particularly when they talk about military options, and of course the UN's talking about economic sanctions, even though the place has been under sanctions, it would seem to me that there's no solution to this in terms of hard power. But the only solution is through soft power. And it seems to me that the Kim family, particularly this 33-year-old boy emperor, is... Time eventually is against them. He strikes me as being like King Canute, sitting in his chair on the beach, defying the tide. Inevitably, information will get into his country, won't it? And that's his biggest fear.
Well, the situation has already changed considerably. North Koreans today have much more access to outside information than they did 10 years ago. It's, of course, not officially allowed, but people do get word, media, telephone calls, and so on from the outside to a limited extent. But you're right that sanctions have not had an effect, and it's not clear that they will. And military confrontation is not, I think, going to make Kim back down. On the contrary, I think a show of force on the U.S. and South Korean side will only make him try to batten down the hatches and improve his defenses even more. What has had some effect in the past actually has been diplomacy. If there has been a kind of meeting of the parties involved, particularly the U.S. and North Korea, but also South Korea, China, Russia, and so on, we've had some instances in which North Korea has agreed to freeze its nuclear program and even in 2005 begin to dismantle its nuclear program. It would be hard to do at this point because they're much farther along. But it seems to me the best bet is some kind of combination of sanctions and diplomacy, which could point the whole situation, in North Korea in particular, to a positive direction, something like perhaps what we've seen in Iran, which seems to have been effective up to this point. But I wouldn't count on Kim Jong-un's regime going away anytime soon. Anything is possible, but they've been remarkably resilient at keeping in power for almost 70 years now, and I wouldn't rule out the possibility that Kim could hang on for a while longer.
So then, just in the last minute or so, Charles Armstrong, what is this constant talk about China leaning on them? It seems to me that China doesn't mind sort of having this kind of attack dog that it keeps saying, well, you know, it's not really our problem. I mean, we can talk to it, but it doesn't necessarily obey our orders.
Well, China's biggest fear is instability in North Korea and an increase of American presence right on its border. So they want to keep North Korea as a viable entity. They will put some pressure on North Korea, and they're clearly very unhappy and dissatisfied and frustrated with these latest actions, and in fact explicitly warn North Korea or tried to persuade them not to launch this satellite. But for the Chinese leadership, a nuclear North Korea is less of a threat than an unstable North Korea or a Korea unified under South Korea, who's a close ally of the U.S. So we're at this point of a standoff now, and it seems the only way forward is to somehow get the sides to discuss a positive solution that may involve military deterrence and sanctions, but will also have a diplomatic endgame that the sides can work toward.
Yeah, but why doesn't China want to have North Korea be a little more like it is? So what's the point of having this dangerous ally?
China very much wants North Korea to be like it is and to go toward economic reform and to be less provocative. They've been trying to send that message for 20 years now. The problem is that the North Koreans are not listening, and you'd think the Chinese would have given up by now, but they seem to still hope that they can restrain North Korea enough that the situation will not escalate out of control. And again, North Korea with nuclear weapons and missile technology is dangerous for much of the world, but an unstable or collapsing North Korea is China's greatest fear at this point.
Well, Charles Armstrong, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Armstrong, who's a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. And his latest book, just out in paperback, is Tyranny of the Weak. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Henri Bakke, the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He was a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. And he, along with Graham Fuller, the authors of Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and he has an article at Foreign Policy, Erdogan's Foreign Policy is in Ruins. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Bakke.
Thank you.
And it does seem that not only is Erdogan's foreign policy in ruins, so is Saudi Arabia, the other country that's supporting the rebels in Syria, who are now, Aleppo is in danger of being encircled by Assad's forces along with Hezbollah, the Iranians, and Russian air power, and probably boots on the ground. But I would suggest that perhaps Washington's policy's in tatters as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the problem, unfortunately, is that while the Russians know exactly what they want in Syria, we don't. And we are floundering. We are one day doing one thing, another day doing another thing. The regional countries which expect leadership from us are not getting it. And the problem is that everybody has a different interest in the region. And the Saudis want one thing, the Turks want another thing. We think we do want something. I'm not sure what it is, but the problem is that there are too many groups, too many countries involved. And as a result, you saw what happened in Geneva. The parties could not even agree to sit at the table. And unfortunately, more civilians are being forced to leave Syria. And the Russians, as you pointed out, the Syrians with Russian and Iranian help are about to capture Aleppo. And if they do, the stream of refugees is going to increase dramatically. Some people say 500,000, others say a million refugees will stream towards Turkey. And this is not a tenable situation, clearly.
But those that don't get out of Aleppo will be used by Assad and the Russians as they are starving these other towns. They'll put them under siege and just starve them out. That seems to be just as much a part of Assad's arsenal as anything else.
Yes. I mean, look, what the Russians and Assad are trying to do is essentially have a line of control along the major highway from Damascus to Aleppo. Everything to the west of that highway will be under Assad's control, and they clearly don't care what's to the east of that. As long as they can push the rebels away from that highway so that the rebels won't bother them, or if they do, it will be acceptable casualties. I think that's what the best the Russians and the Syrians think they can get, and they will be very satisfied. That will give them enough leverage in future negotiations with all the other powers. What is interesting, of course, is the long-term game that the Russians are playing. We are not really sure. I don't think anybody's sure what the Russians really wanted in the end. There are some credible rumors that the Russians might agree down the road into some kind of confederation in Syria with, the Sunnis, the Alawites, the Kurds, maybe the Druze, each getting their all little kingdoms, but all essentially run by the center in Damascus with autonomy. We don't know. I mean, the Russians are occasionally making some signs to that effect, but at the moment, they clearly want to capture Aleppo, create more problems for Europe by pushing refugees to Turkey, and then Turkey will be under pressure to let refugees go to Europe. So, despite the fact that Europeans don't want them to do that, obviously, but nonetheless, it creates havoc for Europe. It makes the U.S. administration look weak. And it strengthens, obviously, Moscow's and Damascus's hand in future negotiations.
Well, I've never heard Secretary of State John Kerry be more angry as he was when he spoke yesterday about Russia's bombing of civilians and how not only are they indiscriminate and repeating what they did in Chechnya, where they basically just destroyed Grozny, they're also bombing, killing all these civilians, and then when the rescue workers come in, they come back and bomb them again. That was what Kerry was describing. So, I mean, are we just sort of helplessly whining on the sidelines? Is that the best we can do?
Look, the problem is, at the moment, this is the best we can do because I don't think anybody in Washington or anybody in the United States at the moment has any idea of what to do. It would have been much more sensible if the U.S. had come out with a policy, however imperfect, about the future of Syria and say, look, this is what we want. This is what we think will work. And get the allies, all of the allies, behind that policy and then confront the Russians at the negotiating table. But it hasn't done that. I mean, the administration is wasting its time at the moment talking about little ceasefires that will never come into existence. That the logic of the situation on the ground is such that you cannot impose a ceasefire. Even if you succeed, nobody's going to monitor the ceasefires, and the local groups are under nobody's control. So you need to come up with a much grander plan and say, look, we need to do this. I mean, one possible such plan is, I actually suggested in the piece, but is to say, look, the only way Syria can stay together is we think of a confederation along ethnic and sectarian lines. At least this will stop the violence, and then we'll think about, rebuilding Syria over the course of 5, 10, 15 years, and then we'll see what happens. But at the moment, there's not that much U.S. can do because it doesn't know what it wants to do.
And again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and is the author with Graham Fuller of Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Erdogan's Foreign Policy is in Ruins. Now, given that the Saudis and Turkey now basically, I don't think they have a plan or a policy, but with all those refugees flooding into Turkey and Erdogan looking humiliated, since he's a little bit unstable or quixotic or impetuous, is it possible that he will send in military forces? I can't imagine him doing it without the U.S. having his back, and I don't believe the U.S. does have his back.
The problem with a military force is that the Turks don't need the United States to send in troops. I mean, they have plenty of troops, they have the capability, but they will take casualties, and that's going to be the problem for Erdogan, and that casualties will be very unpopular at home. At a time when he's trying to change the constitution, it will be a diversion. There are now all these rumors that the Turks will allow a large, very large contingent of Saudi troops cross the come and cross into Syria. I don't believe that either. It is a major dilemma for Erdogan, but he's maneuvering at the moment to say, this is not my fault, this is the fault of the Western powers, that are not taking refugees, that are not doing anything in Syria. There's a way in which you can argue that the Saudis and the Turks have a much clearer idea of what they want, because their argument is, you need to get rid of Assad. Assad is the main reason why you have refugees, why you have a civil war. And until you deal with Assad, you're not going to end this thing. To some extent, I think they make sense. The problem is that it's not you cannot get rid of Assad at the moment. His army is on the upswing. He has complete support from the Iranians and the Russians and Hezbollah. So why should he compromise? Why should he leave? There's absolutely no reason why Assad should agree to leave. And beyond that, I don't think the Russians or the Iranians want him to leave. Assad is not the master of his own destiny anymore. He has mortgaged essentially his future to Iranians and Russians, and they will decide ultimately whether he goes or stays. And everything we've seen so far is that the Iranians do not want him to go. So we are where we are, and as much as the Turkish and the Saudi position makes sense logically, it is not a realistic position. Nobody is going to overthrow Assad.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary that when you go back to the beginning of the uprising, it went on for about 6 months before Assad, the civil war began. And that was the time when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was saying that Assad's going to go, he's finished. Erdogan was saying he's finished. He's, you know, it's just a matter of time before he falls. Nothing was being done. But now you've got, even up to more recent times after the Russian intervention, you've got Deputy Secretary of State Tony Blinken predicting that the Russians are going to get caught in a quagmire in Syria. And it certainly doesn't look like a quagmire. It looks like they're redrawing the map to their advantage.
Look, I mean, we actually, with the Turks, did predict at the beginning of the civil war that Assad had 6 months to live, so to say, and we were wrong. It doesn't mean that Tony Blinken is wrong when he says that the Russians are in a quagmire, because even if the Russians are on the upswing, we are only looking at this sliver of time. A year from now, we don't know what position they will be. I mean, the reason why I think the Russians ultimately will be willing to compromise is because once they've consolidated, once they have a strong hand, then they will be interested in having a deal, because they know that they cannot stay forever fighting instead of Syrians or bombing, because eventually the insurgency is going to change tactics and you'll see more and more Russians being targeted, and they will start paying a price too. So the Russians know that very well. So I think almost by definition, it is a quagmire, except that at the moment it doesn't look that the price they're paying is huge. But I think Tony Blinken is right. I mean, in the long run, they will be in a very difficult situation, just not now.
But in the meantime, thousands and thousands of Syrians die and the country is destroyed, not that it's almost all destroyed already, at least large swaths of the country. It does appear that the Russians have made a deal with the Israelis, and I believe that the rebels believe...
What deal? I don't think there's a deal of any kind.
Well, I thought that they had a sort of deconfliction arrangement on the southern border.
Yeah, but that's not a deal. I mean, Israelis routinely fly over Syrian territory and Lebanese territory to monitor Hezbollah, and the fact that the Russians brought in S-400 missiles that now cover all of northern Israel and Syria and parts of Turkey has created problems for NATO, for the United States, for the Israelis. Everybody is deconflicting with the Russians because it's very dangerous if they don't. But that's not a deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say thank you for correcting me, but my understanding is that the Syrian rebels believe that the Americans have made a deal with the Russians, and they feel that they've been sold out.
Well, you're right about the fact that the Syrian rebels feel stabbed in the back. And the fact is that the more the Russians and the Americans talk to each other, the more the rebels are going to think that they're being sold out, almost by definition. And remember, this is a war situation where atrocities are being committed. This is a situation where reason already in societies in which conspiracy theories are the norm rather than the exception. It is quite natural that people are going to think that they're being sold out. That's very natural.
But it's pretty clear, isn't it, all along, that the idea that Russia is joining the fray, as Putin said, to get rid of the Islamic State, is pretty clear all along that they've really been targeting those forces that are most threatening to Assad, mainly Jabhat al-Nusra, and the other army of liberation, I can't remember
the name. The Army of Islam, yes.
Yeah, the Army of Islam. They managed to kill its leader. That's been pretty clear, isn't it? I mean, does anybody in Washington believe that there's any targeting of the Islamic State by Russia?
No, absolutely not. I mean, and that's the Russians have managed to convince their own population, and maybe the Syrians, that they're doing that, but nobody believes it. But there's not, again, much the United States can do. We're not about to shoot down a Russian airplane and start a third world war. So, you know, the stakes here are very, very large.
But could the U.S. have done anything before the Russians moved in? I mean, was there any way to deter the Russians from coming in? It seemed that we got caught by surprise.
Yes, you have to remember why the Russians intervened. The Russians intervened because the Syrian army was in a terrible situation. There was the possibility that they may lose this town of Latakia, which is a major stronghold for Assad and his supporters, and also there, close to the Russian naval base, etc. Therefore, the Russians felt compelled to intervene. In a way, it was the success of the rebels that brought the Russians into Syria. Could the United States prevented that? No. But the United States could have, maybe earlier on, have been much more forceful in trying to push for a solution instead of kind of letting the situation evolve on its own steam. The United States did try to stop the Turks from allowing Islamic State and other jihadists crossing the border into Syria, but it didn't do enough to focus the energies of the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks on the more moderate elements. All these highly factious groups and extremist groups that have emerged are really the result of all these countries picking their own proxies. I mean, this is really a proxy war. Everybody has their own proxies there. And the United States could have maybe imposed much more of a discipline. Maybe not. I mean, look, I'm sure they tried, but my sense is that the administration wasn't that, with the exception of its reaction after Kobani and the Kurds, it wasn't very imaginative. But look, it's easy to say from the sidelines to shout strategies. The reality is this is a very difficult situation. I mean, as much as we want to blame Washington, we also have to realize that there aren't any good solutions here. This is a terrible civil war, and maybe it will burn itself out one day, but at a terrible cost. The other alternative is for everybody to send armies into Syria. And look, after Iraq, Obama is not going to send regular troops into Syria. He made it very clear.
Well, just in closing, though, you don't feel that Turkey's likely to intervene, and it would be a little tricky, wouldn't it, having a NATO partner butting heads with the Russians, if not shooting at each other?
That's a very good point. There's no question that were the Turks to intervene militarily, they open themselves up to Russian counter-reaction, and as you said, Turkey is a NATO country, and therefore this would be opening a new can of worms. But if the Russians were not to counter this, because look, if the Turks intervene, they're going to intervene not to overthrow Assad. They're going to intervene to create a safe zone for the refugees, so that all those 500,000 to a million refugees that are potentially on the move do not cross into Turkish territory. And so create the refugee camps on the Syrian side of the border and not in Turkey. That would be the reason why the Turks would intervene. It would not be to fight Assad or the Syrians. But the devil's in the details. If you go in with military forces, ISIS would love to take pot shots at Turkish soldiers and create problems between Turkey and the regime in Syria, between Turkey, the Turkish government and its population. You know, so that's what the Turks are afraid of.
Well, Henri Baki, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Henri Baki, who is the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. And along with Graham Fuller, is the author of Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Erdogan's Foreign Policy is in Ruins. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.